I love how passionate you are about it. And that's one thing I really have felt. And I think we just need more and more people that are this passionate to come and spread the good that is actually going on.
I can't believe it's someone's job to go out and just taste cheese. I mean, surely that is completely job goals.
I describe the future as tuna, like the fish, turbulent, uncertain, novel, ambiguous.
I mean, we do not have a Christmas tree at home. Sounds a bit mean, especially having children. But we have a bit of a tradition over the last 7 years to have a Christmas bush.
A Christmas bush?
An actual Christmas bush, yeah. This episode is supported by our headline partner, Virgin Money. Virgin Money supports farmers with funding, diversification loans and expert financial advice, backed by years of experience and specialist agricultural managers. We're really pleased that they are partnering with the show to enable it to happen. Thank you, Virgin Money.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Meet the Farmers, The Big Debate, Episode 2. We're back, and my name is Ali Hunter-Blair.
And I'm Sophie Gregory.
Well, we're back. We haven't been booted off, which is a miracle, potentially. Thank you so much to everyone that has listened, watched, commented, sent us messages directly or via Ben. We've had so much feedback, and a lot of it has been positive, which is good, which I think is why we're still here. There's been some constructive criticism, which is great. We are very much learning our trade and trying to get better at what we do. But yeah, thank you so much for everyone that has been in touch with us at all. It has been, a bit of a roller coaster of emotions as it got released. And I'm delighted to be back because we have got a fantastic episode this week. We have been speaking to Brazilian journalist Mariana Grilli about COP30, which is happening in Brazil at the moment. And then also Professor Tim Benton about net zero, which is our big debate topic, basically why UK farmers should worry about being net zero. We've got two news stories that we found interesting, and we've also got a final topic about Christmas trees, which I am very, very excited about. We are recording this on Thursday, the 13th of November. We spoke to Mariana Grilli yesterday, which was Wednesday, the 12th of November. So, without further ado, I think we should get started. I'm very excited. Sophie, I would really like to know where you are first and what's been happening in your life for the last 2 weeks.
So currently I'm in an ironing cupboard. Yep, it's the only quiet space I could find. So I've been over here for Global Organic meetings with our milk buyer, the farmer-owned cooperative Arla. I'm in the, would be a broom cupboard. I'm actually going to apologise in case my light goes out. Denmark is hot on sustainability, so any light is on a sensor, so it could go out any time. So I'm not waving my arms in despair at Ali, I'm just waving them to try and keep the sensor running. I have had quite a busy 2 weeks because we are still in demolition derby, and I'm gonna house my cows. It's Thursday today, tonight for the first time, so I just have been doing maybe a little bit of soil crime, which I've not been that comfortable with, but we haven't, the concrete's only just dried. So we're going to come in tonight. The cows are going to go in overnight. They'll go out to graze in the day, but just that will be a little bit of pressure off me because I've been feeling a little bit about them still being out. But it's just the only time we could get builders in. And yeah, they've done a great job, but we move at different paces is probably the right thing to say. How about you, Ali? How's everything down at, up in Herefordshire, I should say?
It has been, I should be honest, a bit of a quieter spell here. It's been wet, so obviously getting onto land has been more tricky. We're sprayed up. We've been loading out some barley, which didn't make malting quality, which has upset me greatly. That's been going out for feed at a very, very horribly cheap price compared to what it had been sold for malting. So that's put me on a Debbie Downer. I don't know. I'm still pretty happy with how the farm looks currently. We have got a forecast that is horrific for tomorrow, Friday. They're talking of 50 mil of rain over the next 24 hours. The flood, we've already got a flood warning out as well. So I think by Monday afternoon, a third of my farm will be underwater. So I'll be able to get the drone out and post some footage, and then everyone will accuse me of ruining the river probably. But the farm's been pretty quiet. We have got a top secret project which I've been starting to work on, but I can't actually tell anybody yet because I haven't told anybody apart from my wife on the farm. So that's a really good piece for a podcast. If you can't actually tell, I hate it when people do that. People do that on social media again all the time as well. It's like, oh, I'm working on this top secret project that I can't tell you anything. It's so annoying. So I'm going to stop talking there because, yeah, I can't say anything else.
So we're now going to head over to speak to Mariana Grilli, who's a journalist from Brazil. She's going to give us a bit of an insight to COP30, which kicked off on Monday in Brazil. We're also going to learn a bit more about Brazilian agriculture. Thanks so much for joining us, Mariana. Can you give us a bit more of a background?
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Well, I've been covering agribusiness in Brazil that are 10 years, and I've been specializing my coverage between agribusiness, so agriculture, livestock production, and the relation to climate changes, environmental issues, and the future of farming in not only Brazil, but around the world. And I love to make this relation also with markets and how we can contribute, for example, with energy transition. So yeah, I hope we have a good conversation here.
Fantastic. And obviously the reason we want to talk to you is that COP30 is being held in Brazil for the first time. How important is that, do you think, to Brazil, to the Amazon rainforest?
Well, first of all, I think I need to say that I've been in COP28 in Dubai. And before that, in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh edition, they started to talk more about food security and its relation to climate change. So I've been reading and involved with COPs since they're kind of, and now this year in Brazil, it's so important because, first of all, it's a COP, we say, in the middle of the forest. It's not in the middle of the forest, okay? Belém is a huge city. It's a urban environment, but yeah, for sure, it's a capital that it's a symbol of Amazon forest, and it's so different from the other countries that it's based, this economy based on fossil fuels. So in Brazil, we have almost the most clean energy in the world. For example, we use ethanol produced from sugarcane most of the history, but in the last years the corn production it's getting bigger because of the ethanol too, and biodiesel because of the soybean production.
That's fascinating. I think a lot of our listeners will be interested in the fact that you're producing energy as well as farming within the same area, because I think there's a lot of assumptions around Brazil and how they produce food and, you know, the rainforest. And is there anything you want to add to explain it to the outer world? I went last year and I was just blown away by how productive the farming was there. Is there anything else that we should know in the UK that explains, you know, Brazilian agriculture?
Well, yeah, I could spend the whole day talking about it, but... Yeah, I think it's important to remember that Brazil is a huge country, so we have different realities. We have different kinds of agriculture and different kinds of farmers. So we have the smallholder ones, we have huge farmers that are one of the biggest in the world. So these different realities brings difficulties sometimes because of the use of technology, the access of credit and financial possibilities. So I think one of the biggest thing that that we can keep in mind is that Brazil has the technology to bring solutions to every kind of farm in Brazil. So These solutions can go further and can go abroad. The thing is, for example, we have in Brazil an integration system of production that it's called ILPF. So it's like integration in Portuguese is integração lavoura pecuária floresta. It's an integration of grains, livestock, and forest. So in the same area, there is a technology and a kind of an intelligent system of production. Then you have, for example, soybean And then you have the cattle after the soybean is harvested. And at the same time, this cattle can go next to the trees so they can have a more comfortable life. So you can produce everything at the same time. It's not something so easy to do. So it's a technology that's getting bigger in Brazil, but the farmers have to be prepared for this, including in a financial way, because most of times they are learning how to do it, learning how to have grains and livestock and forest. So this part of the forest is probably it's one of the biggest challenges, because farmers are not usual to work with the forest as an economic way to look the trees and know that they in the future can bring money, for example. So this is the kind of conversation that it's getting bigger in Brazil, and it's one of the things that Brazilian government are trying to spread in COP30, and also others mechanisms, for example, the TFFF, the Tropical Forest Forever Fund, that brings money to keep safe the tropical forests. But yeah, that's it. Lots of farmers in Brazil, because of the code law, our law in Brazil obligates farmers to have forests and native forests in their farms. So the big discussion is how these Brazilian farmers can keep these tropical forests inside their areas, not devastating them, and at the same time, earn money and make this area profitable. So it's a big discussion that involves farmers and financial systems and all of the biggest companies of agriculture in the world, the land area, how to use the land in a more intelligent way.
I think it's fascinating, because as Soph said there, the information that potentially we're fed about Brazilian farming is negative. I don't know whether that's because the UK press is quite negative about farming in general, or whether that's because, so we're constantly fed deforestation, Amazon being destroyed. You know, we're never fed these good news stories. And I guess that's why COP can be really key for this, to publicize the fact, like, all of this stuff that, you know, I didn't know a huge amount about, that are really good. And obviously, like President Lula, he was one of his big pledges was to sort of solve world hunger. And I think it's really interesting that you're mentioning food sustainability, and, you know, food and people is as important as the production. Overnight, they've signed the Belém Declaration, which is to, you know, to try and help with hunger and poverty and affecting the people that are hit the worst by this climate change. How important do you think that is for the president, amazingly, and also for the country?
Actually, 2-3 years ago, Brazilian has left the hunger map of UN. We were out of this map, and in Bolsonaro's government, Brazil came back to this map, and the hunger got bigger in Brazil. And for me, as a journalist specialized in agribusiness, is something that I can't stand, because if we are huge producers, hunger in Brazil should be the last problem. But it's a reality. But in the last 2 years, I guess, Brazil so left again the hunger map. So it's a good point. But it doesn't mean that we don't have people facing hunger in Brazil, because it's, as I said, we have a different reality. It's not only for farms, but for people in general, north, south. Brazil is so big. It's so many different realities. So what Brazil is trying to talk about in this COP too, it's about the agroecology and smallholder farmers' role to food people, because we know in Brazil that between 70% and 80% of the food that we have in our plates comes from smallholder farmers. So we have these both realities that can live together, survive together. The smallholder farmers who brings us tomatoes, potatoes, and lettuce, and everything that we can eat every day, you know, rice and beans, very famous in Brazil. And we also have this important role of the big farmers to soybean and corn and sugarcane, coffee, orange juice, and so on. So one of the things that we can keep in mind is that it's very important to get more power and strength to, we call in Brazil, agricultura familiar, the way that smallholder farmers survive facing climate changes, because that's the point. If they are small ones, and if they are, for example, they have 1 hectare or 2 hectares, if they are facing climate changes in so small area and they have, I don't know, problems with the weather, sometimes they're going to lose everything. They're going to lose their business and they're going to lose their money sometimes for the whole year or for the whole life. So it's very dangerous. So we must think about this infrastructure to keep them in field, to keep them cultivating different kinds of production, not only monoculture. So it's kind of two kind of markets that can walk together. And that's the beautiful thing that sometimes even Brazilian people don't see that.
There's an element of me sitting here as an observer that says the previous COPs have failed because we've hit this 1.5 degree target now. We hit that in 2024. And the USA aren't there as a country. I know that there are states from the US there, and there's a lot of people from the US at the COP, but you know, the USA is not there as a nation. And I feel that that seems where some of the money could be from. Is there an element of sort of trying to deal with a failure of not reaching this target? And what is the main priorities for this COP30?
Well, that's a hard question. Yeah. I think the thing is focused on solutions, not only in problems. So, for example, when you say U.S. doesn't make part of this COP, and we know that from since Trump came back to the government. So at this year, U.S. is still a member, but it's not participating, and probably the next year it's not going to be a member of COPs in general because of the Paris Agreement and so on. I think we must focus on solutions. So one of the things that Brazil is trying to scream to the COP30, it's about methodologies to calculate the carbon in the soil. Because to credit carbon market, the standards of carbon market, it was developed by European reality, European scientists. So a different kind of agriculture and a different kind of soil and snow weather. We don't have snow in Brazil. So how are we going to measure our soil health based on the same methodology as an European methodology? It doesn't make sense. So it's a scientific conversation. It's not only about a smallholder farmer, a big farmer of soybean in Mato Grosso. No, it's a scientific conversation that needs to be more adult. You know, like, in Brazil, we used to say that we feed the world, okay? So, yeah, soy, corn bean, and sugar cane, fruits, mangoes. That's the thing. How we can start measuring this soil health based on our reality, our mathematics, our metrics. It's a waste of time if we're gonna spend our time talking about U.S. it's not involved, or China is the most polluter in the world. So we need to talk to them about it. But in our reality in Brazil, we are decreasing deforestation. We are trying to obey our laws in the best way we can, and at the same time producing food, fuel, fibers in general, with amazing technologies, but we need to strengthen our farmers, strengthen our local communities, and show the world our necessities, for example, about the soil metrics. So if US or other countries don't want to participate, what a pity. Yeah, but I think we can go further. We must go further. We must think as a global community. It's the same planet. We are facing climate change at the same way. So if we don't start to talk the same and to have a health conversation, a health dialogue to our future and our food and community, we don't gonna go anywhere, you know?
Yeah, I love how passionate you are about it. And that's one thing I really it really is. And I think we just need more and more people that are this passionate to come and spread the good that is actually going on. Because I think there's always a bit of negativity coming out of COPs that not enough action has been achieved. But I think even by those same people being in the same room, these conversations happen that we don't even know about that then spark other things. So I think it's, yeah, really exciting. And it'll be good to catch up after COP's been to see actually what went down. So thanks so much for coming. It's been absolutely fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So obviously we just had Mariana there that, I could talk to her for hours about everything. And she's so passionate about Brazil in particular, but I think it's really interesting to see her views, especially on maybe bigger countries not being involved in COP and that sort of attitude to being along the lines of, if they don't want to be involved, that's fine, but we can still solve our own problems. What did you make of it?
I mean, it was really interesting to see how important it was for them to have it in the country with agriculture being so high on importance for them. She was saying about how they are managing to combine the rainforest, crop production, even energy production, all within the same area. And I just find it fascinating learning about different ways of farming as well.
Yeah, and I think that's the big thing from us, isn't it? We often sit inside our own box and don't look out. But then that point that she sort of kept making, that, you know, how can European countries understand Brazilian systems where we don't have rainforests? We haven't got any. I mean, we got rid of all of our forests years and years ago. So how can we sort of sit there and go, right, this is how the Brazilians should be farming? But I suppose the key thing that we really needed to focus on is the importance of COP being in Brazil, the importance of COP being in the Amazon or near the Amazon. And I really wanted to push more on that point of the fact that they failed. I think that that's something that is, I know it's a negative point, but where do we go now? That's what I really wanted to see, is that where do we go now that we've hit that 1.5 degree target? And now reversing it is going to be very difficult, but how do we focus on trying to keep it there, I guess, and trying to improve?
Yeah, and I think it's interesting how farming weaves into that, because it's very easy for us to think, oh, COP's nothing to do with us. But actually, last year they had a whole day on food and farming. Each of the pavilions, so like the tents, there's a tent per country, put on a food and farming day. And it really highlighted to me how important each country farming was for them, if that makes sense. So, you know, Australia really put out the red carpet. They had the head of their NFU. They had a special representative from government. And then the UK did transport that day. It's not really showing much for farming, is it?
No, and it tells you pretty much everything you need to know, especially in the year that you were there. And it'd be interesting to know what they're doing this year when they're over there. I see that my landlord has been criticised for flying over on a private jet, when you're thinking, well, how else is he going to get to Brazil? But at least he's there as an agricultural landowner to try and make a difference and have his, and obviously wherever he goes, press follows. So there's an argument for me that I go, well, absolutely, he should be over there. He brings press attention with him. He's getting over there. He is passionate about this. It always comes back to us. Like, there's an article came out in the BBC 2 days ago that Amazon tree felling is responsible for the pollution in the River Wye. And you're there going, well, how have you linked that back to the Amazon? And also what we've just heard from Mariana, the difference between what we get fed every day, and they're saying that obviously soya is produced in the Brazil, it comes over to the UK, it's fed to the chickens that are in Herefordshire, the muck is then spread. So they've linked it all the way back to them blaming tree felling in Brazil. But then what we've just heard from Mariana is that it's not as simple as that. And actually this negative news that we get fed is so different to reality.
Absolutely. And so it was so good to have her actual view on it, wasn't it, Ali? I think that that's something that I really appreciate within agriculture is learning how it's done outside of, like you were saying earlier, outside of our silos, because actually, you know, there could be things that we could learn from them. That's what I really found there.
I think the point that she was making there as well about the understanding, that's something that it just seems key for me, is that we often sit, the UK, particularly the EU, I guess, we sit on our high horse with our high standards and our box-ticking exercises for our assurance schemes and bits and bobs. And then we sort of shout at other countries. But then you look at Brazil, you look at where COP is being hosted at, they produce 70% of their own food, which is way higher than we are, and way higher than we will ever be. So it's... I find that really difficult. I find that really difficult to criticize a country that, A, we don't have a full understanding of, and then also a country that is far more self-sufficient than we are, to be able to sit here and criticize that because we think we're doing things better. It doesn't sit right with me.
No, I definitely feel the same. And I think that because they've had such a spotlight on them, they have been pushed towards doing a lot for the rainforest. I'm not saying that it's perfect. I'm saying far from that, but they have been pushed under the spotlight within the conversations of soya. You know, if we're talking about it on the ground within our sustainability models, just think the highlighting, you know, that's going on in Brazil about it. So I think that's what's happened. I think it's always important to have a balanced view on this. And, you know, on farm, for you guys listening, but the UK farmers, you know, a lot of us will be feeding stuff that's imported and a lot of us won't have a clue how it's produced. So I think that's why it's really important that we have these conversations, because actually it's just opening a box to more understanding. Does that make sense? Like beforehand, I would have just picked up the phone, made a phone call to, you know, Mole Valley. There's loads of other available. But I wouldn't have even thought about where it's come from or the consequences of that feed. So actually, to me, it's like opening a box, you know, whether that's right or not, I don't know. I will decide, I'm sure. But it's understanding actually how, you know, having a COP in Brazil, talking about these hot topics, it is actually relatable. We're all part of this picture. And, you know, our decisions on farm are impacting people across the world.
Yeah. And I think really the important thing is here is that we are, what, halfway through or middle of the way through COP. We really need to revisit this when it's finished to see what these conclusions, whether actually any agreements have been made, whether there are conclusions. But now we get to move very quickly and quietly onto our new stories of the week, which I'm very excited about this week. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to beat Snail, so I'm going to let you go first. Meet the Farmers, The Big Debate is supported by TELUS Agriculture and Consumer Goods, the team that has brought together FarmPlan and Gatekeeper. Their ongoing investment equips farmers with the tools they need today and those they will need to face tomorrow's farming challenges. We're using their farm management software on our farm for spray plans, stock control, and much, much more. Designed to give you complete control of your data and simplify your day-to-day operations. Whether you are tracking your inputs, managing costs, or planning ahead, TELUS makes your business more efficient and informed. Find out more at telus.com/bigdebate. Once again, that's telus.com/bigdebate. So we're going to move on to our news stories. Every week we're going to choose a news story that's been interesting to us. I chose snails last week and I'm not sure I can top that. But Sophie, what have you got for us this week?
So this week, I'm going to be taking you to Bern in Switzerland. So between the 13th and the 15th of November, it's going to be World Cheese Awards there. And what I loved about this story was that there's going to be over 4,500 cheeses from more than 40 countries. And the judging panel is 250 judges. So think about how many cheeses each one of those judges is going to have to taste. And then what I really loved is that there's a super jury of 14 judges who will taste for the super gold winners to choose the overall champion. I mean, I don't think it gets better than that.
How do we get into this? Ben, in the background, you're there. We've got to go. We have to go, surely. I love cheese.
Some of the cheese names are so good as well. They are absolutely brilliant, like Nanny Blue, you know, like unbelievable names. So I just, yeah, I feel like it might be a prompt.
I can't believe it's someone's job to go out and just taste cheese. I mean, surely that is completely job goals. Like, there's nothing you could ever want to do more than go out and be like, I'm actually the aficionado on cheese tasting. Like, it's the perfect dinner party conversation. So what do you do? Well, actually, I taste cheese for a living. Incredible.
So specific, isn't it? And I really, when I read this on the BBC, I was like, this can't be for real. So I had to do a bit of research around it. But it's a real, real deal. And it's every year. And I mean, each country do their own thing as well. So something is going on most of the time in the cheese world.
I mean, you win new story of the week. I can't top that. I started too soon with snail farming in Westminster, and I've gone too high, and I can't beat it this week. So this week it's loosely agricultural because machinery, but I don't know if you saw on the news on Saturday night, a drunk driver took control of a 24-ton bulldozer and drove it around the streets of Wolverhampton for 2.5 hours it actually took them to stop him. And now I'd just like to say that I obviously do not condone, there's no need to do that on me now, Soph, go dark like that. I don't condone obviously drink driving, and he was arrested and rightfully so. But the audacity to take a 24-ton bulldozer and drive it through the streets, and the videos around on TikTok and everything else, there's a Royal Mail lorry parked himself across the road to try and stop the bulldozer, just pushed him out the way. And I've only brought this new story up because nobody was hurt and they've arrested the chap, because obviously it could be very, very serious. And that's sort of why I wanted to bring it in, is that our tractors all start with the same key. Like, how has this guy got into a bulldozer and driven it around for 2.5 hours around Wolverhampton? Surely that should never happen. But the footage, now that I know nobody got hurt, is hilarious.
You handled that very well. Very PC of you, Ali. Brilliant story, I think. I mean, we've all done some silly things in our past in vehicles, etc. But I think that, what a story, hey?
Stealing a bulldozer is up there. It is up there. Right. Well, that's the news stories. You win, Soph. You absolutely win with that. We're now going to move on to our big debate this week, where we're joined by Professor Tim Benton. And our topic is, the UK share of global emissions is 1%. Why should UK farmers still aim for net zero? I'm delighted that we have Professor Tim Benton for our big debate this week. He is a scientist based at the University of Leeds and has a long list of accolades that I am going to have to read. From 2011 to 2016, he was the champion for UK's Global Food Security Programme. 2019 to 2024, he was the research director for Energy, Environment and Resources at Chatham House, and serving as a distinguished fellow. And he is also the co-lead for the Agri-Food and Net Zero Network Plus.
Thanks, Tim, so much for coming today. Our topic this week for the big debate is, the UK share of global emissions is 1%. Why should UK farmers still aim for net zero? Can you give us a brief explanation for the context of this question, Tim? The UK only produces about 1% of global emissions. So what difference can we really make? Can you explain why it's still such a focus on net zero here?
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about this for hours, of course, but broadly speaking, climate change is a collective action problem, that we need to tackle climate change, and we need to everyone take part in tackling that climate change. And I was trying to think up kind of analogies. None of us say, well, my income is only 0.001% of UK income, so therefore I don't have to pay tax on it because it won't make a difference. None of us say, I don't have to obey the laws because other people perhaps aren't obeying the laws, because we realise that if we go in that direction, everything kind of falls apart. So there is a question in terms of, there is a short-term cost, obviously, to change. There always is. there are long-term benefits, and how do we individually think about that sort of thing? You know, if you took a pure cost-benefit analysis, you might never take out insurance. So there is, you know, in how we think about these things, there is always a question about, should I be doing it? Is what I'm doing worth it relative to everybody else? But where we're tackling these very big challenges, at one level, there is an answer that we have to tackle them together, otherwise nothing gets done and paralysis comes. But in terms of kind of some of the specifics, from a kind of farmer-centric perspective, I think there are kind of two broad arguments. One is self-interest. Now, we know that climate change is driving a whole lot of different things on farm, whether it's flooding or whether it's heat and drought and all the rest of that, and making farming generally more difficult. And climate is also driving a whole range of different things that are affecting markets. So, you know, whether it is the war in Ukraine affecting fertilizer prices and food prices and so on. Those two things together are meaning that the future is going to be much more volatile and much more uncertain. And every farmer is going to have to adapt to the market drivers, to the volatility, to the climate drivers and so on. And as part of that adaptation, building resilience, there is a whole lot that can be done that also is better from a sustainability perspective, from a reducing emissions perspective, but also better from a biodiversity and pollution type perspective. And the kind of corollary of this argument that actually it's in your long-term interest to steer the change to tackle the range of challenges is if collectively UK farming does not adapt, does not mitigate, and emissions continue to grow, your job as farmers is going to become more difficult because the climate volatility is going to increase. So in a sense, saying it's somebody else's problem, I'm not going to bother, just stores up problems for yourself. So that's the first one, is the kind of individual self-interest. And the second thing is broadly aligned with that, and that's the social, societal self-interest. We are passing through 1.5 degrees now. COP 30 is going on. That's not going to achieve very much. You know, projections are that we're going to be on course for 2.75 degrees, 3 degrees at the end of the century. And everybody is palpably feeling that climate is changing. And I was speaking to a bunch of farmers last week in London, and there were two or three came up to me and said, you know, I've had two bad years. I'm just hoping that this year is going to be a good year. And, you know, when it becomes, I've had four bad years and the fifth year is also a bad year, farmers are going to have to kind of adapt. That's today. You know, it's unimaginable to me what agriculture would look like in a 3-degree world. And, you know, if we do carry on for a 3-degree world, countries will be fighting each other for access to good agricultural land, to water. Globalized trade will break down. We'll have so much contestation and conflict on a global basis. It's not just how do we manage to grow food, it's how do we actually feed ourselves on a global basis in a much more kind of warlike, contested situation. So we don't want to go to a 3-degree world because it's going to be so disruptive. And every sector and every person is going to have to cope with a world like that. And every sector and every person, instead of coping with that change and the negativity that comes from that, could work proactively to avoid those sorts of situations coming through. And particularly the farming, collective farming community, very conservative with a small C and sometimes a big C, but actually building the social capital and saying we're leading the charge, we are trying to make the world a better place rather than we are maximizing productivity to maintain our livelihoods and your climate anxiety doesn't matter. I think there is a kind of, you know, being the good guys in the piece rather than trying to hold back the inevitable change that is coming. And as I say, you know, really it's a matter of recognizing change is coming and steering change to avoid the worst for farming and worse for society as a whole, is the argument that I would make first to say, actually, yeah, let's do this, because it is not just a woke thing. It's not a middle class nice to have. This is an existential risk for us all. And you play a part in that, just as I play a part in that and try to avoid flying and don't have multiple cars and, you know, all the other things that individuals can do.
And I think it's really fascinating. But do you think that there's an element that obviously there's a difference between how climate affects countries of different wealth? And obviously we live in a UK, which is a fairly wealthy country. Do you think that we end up pushing our greenness onto lesser developed countries? Do you think that there's an element of, I don't know, we've had our carbon footprint done because the Duchy of Cornwall require it, and we are in theory carbon negative, which is fantastic. I can pat myself on the back and say that I've done a good job. Do I feel particularly better about it? I don't know if I do. Am I just pushing my greenness somewhere else? I guess my question is do richer countries end up sort of pushing their agenda onto countries that are actually just trying to survive?
Well, inevitably, international affairs is about managing countries' collective interests. And so you could say Trump, through creating trade wars, is pushing his interests on other countries. You can say the exploitative relationships that different countries have with each other is about pushing their own self-interest over some sort of collective self-interest. So I would say that is a kind of a baseline of the way that countries relate to each other. I think what you're really getting at is the rich world imposing on the poor world something that is not in their interests? And I think the answer to that is roundly no. It might not be in their particular short-term interests, however you do it. They might be able to make a faster profit, you know, particularly if you think about somewhere like Nigeria or Venezuela with lots of access to fossil fuels. Should we be saying, no, you can't develop fossil fuels now, you should go straight to solar because you will pollute the world? And there is an argument there to be said, well, actually, for developing countries, give them a bit of leeway. But I don't see how you, Ali, by being a good farmer in the UK, is pushing anything on any other country. The argument would be much more that we would not import from a country that has a different set of standards from us. But, you know, at the moment, we don't have those sorts of trade barriers, though under a different sort of government, as under a Trump government in the US, we might put up all sorts of trade barriers to protect our farming community in a different way than we do at the moment. But I don't think dealing with climate change and dealing with the vulnerability of many lower and middle income countries is not in the long-term interests collectively, because, you know, if you think about the other thing that's obviously a huge debate in the UK and in many countries in the rich world, people movement, people displacement, migration, borders. If we end up living in a three degree world and great swathes of the lower latitudes become much more difficult to inhabit, where are the people going to go? You know, they're not going to stay there and starve necessarily. It's going to be a problem for us as well, not just in, you know, disrupting trade flows, but in the people movement component of it. So that's why it's a collective action problem. We have to solve this together, and that means working collectively together.
I always feel as a farmer that I can't have a big impact, and I hear what you're saying about it being collective effort. How can we empower farmers to feel like they can really make change on the ground, and it adds up to reducing that 1%? I always have been told that if you're not at the table, then you're on the menu. How do we sort of elevate farmers' voices and get them empowered in this space to get them involved? Because I think a lot of people sort of are so focused on keeping their businesses running that this is at the back of their mind.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could say the same for any of us tackling climate change. You know, individual actions don't by themselves give agency of change, but collectively they do. And this is why it becomes the collective that matters more than the individual. The individual's, you know, my carbon footprint makes zero difference as a first approximation. But by me choosing to do certain things in my lifestyle, I am perhaps acting as a champion for climate issues in my local community. I'm showing that it can be done. I'm encouraging others to do it, and so on. So, and if everybody chose to farm in a more sustainable, more mitigated way, then collectively it does start making a difference. But to emphasize my first point again, you're going to have to change. Every farm is going to have to change. And in a world of climate disruption, mitigating emissions by storing more carbon in the soils, for example, builds your resilience and prevents some of the emissions going up. So there are ways ahead of adapting to build resilience that also mitigate part of the problem. And so it's not about just doing the mitigation, reducing the emissions alone. It is reducing the emissions as a pathway to making your business better and more resilient, and acting as a beacon for your neighbouring farmers to show it can be done, and you can make a better livelihood out of it. So, you know, it's not the kind of me lecturing the farming community to saying, you know, you're bad farmers. It's saying, look ahead. The challenge is going to be great for all of you, and better soil management, more agroecological methods in general, more diversity are all ways that you'll build business resilience, and there are ways that also will allow you to mitigate some of your emissions.
I think the resilience thing is really interesting because, as you said, for basically one of your first points there, Tim, was we've had a terrible year, 2024, 2025, as an arable farm in the UK, especially the West Side, has been terrible. But my dad refers that back to 1976. And if that's a 1-in-50-year event, fine. I don't think that's a 1-in-50-year event. I think that's now a 1-in-3, a 1-in-5-year event. So is there an element that we have to, not put up and shut up, that's not the word, but we've gone through this 1.5 degree target. COP30 is happening now. They almost have to talk at COP30 as if they're a failure because they've broken through their target. You're talking of a 3-degree rise. Is there an element now as a farmer in my late 30s that I'm going to have to really look to farm for a 3-degree rise, or is that a worst case scenario?
That's a worst case scenario, but I suspect more plausible is 2 to 2.5 degrees, because, you know, we're not doing what we need to do to get anything like on track. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty into the future, including long-term configuration of the jet stream and how, as that waves around, it creates blocking patterns. So, you know, it's not about a few days of heat. It's about months of dryness or months of wetness. And you're exactly right that, you know, everyone can look back and say, well, there was a bad storm or a flood in this. It's going to be coming with much greater frequency. And it might be much greater frequency than our weather models are predicting at the moment because of some of these changes in the large-scale configuration of the climate, let alone what would happen if the overturning circulation that drives warm water from the tropics to the across the Atlantic up to us, if that turned off, our seasonality would be very, very different. Much deeper winters, much stormier, much drier and hotter summers, much more kind of continental, much more like Labrador and Newfoundland, in fact. So, you know, as I keep on saying, if you look ahead over the next 20 or 30 years, change is inevitable, and that's change in what we grow, how we grow it, where we grow it, the amount we grow. And it's not a matter of saying, oh, I don't want to, can't be bothered with mitigating. There's going to be whole-scale change that is going to be driven through market prices, market collapses, food disruptions. You know, in a more contested world, the kind of global markets might well not have the same bite that they've had in the past. And so will you still be competing with Canada, or will you still be competing with New Zealand over lamb or whatever it will be? The answer to that is probably not in the way that we might imagine it looking back over the last 20 years. So the future, I describe the future as tuna, like the fish, turbulent, uncertain, novel, ambiguous. Turbulent is going to be very fast changing. Uncertain is going to be unpredictable. Novel, new things are going to be thrown at us all the time. And ambiguous, there are always upsides and downsides to every decision. There are always the potential for losing out, people getting hurt, as well as there being winners. So the biggest message, I think, from me to the farming community is not to say you need to mitigate, you need to be more sustainable, but change is coming. The world is more tuna. You're going to have to build a resilience. And a part of building resilience in a world where our National Health Service is creaking and, you know, we need to get people eating better and more healthily, in a world where our trade is much more flaky and we need to think about how we produce more food for domestic consumption, input prices are going to go up and down output prices are going to go up and down, weather's going to go up and down. So in a world of really high volatility, what is your business strategy to keep your head above water? And it's not the same as it has been in the past. And as you're tackling all of these things, there is lots of space for also mitigating and being more sustainable, because ultimately being more sustainable in an ecological sense saves the bottom line and some of the input prices and the risk of being over reliant on fertilizer that you might not be able to import next year, or it might be too expensive for you to use, or whatever it might be.
Brilliant. Tim, thanks so much. You've left me feeling really empowered as a farmer to actually make some changes. I always feel slightly like I'm sort of a very small fish in a big pond, but actually you've really given us some great nuggets there. Thanks so much for coming in. I know how busy you are, and good luck with the rest of your work.
Thank you, and lovely to see you both.
Wow. I have tried to absorb as much of that information as I can. I find it really fascinating when we talk about all this sort of this net zero stuff. I find myself in two minds constantly. And actually, I think Tim has almost answered my own questions for me, which is we sit here as UK farmers going, right, we are targeting net zero. That's the big thing. It's the NFU's big thing. It's the big thing the Dutch are focused on. It's the big thing that I've been focused on, actually, because I believe it's part of our farm resilience is being carbon neutral, as close to it as we can. I just wonder, I still also wonder, being like, well, actually, I probably reduced my productivity because of the way that we're farming now. I struggle with that. This food sustainability, is that as important as the 1% of the global emissions that we are producing as the UK? If we're just going to import our food, why does it matter? And I still struggle with it. And I'm wondering, even now, I'm wondering, okay, I've hit targets that I want to hit. I've hit targets because I believe it's making my farm more resilient, but I don't think it's necessarily helping my bottom line. And that's something that I always come back to. And I'm trying to work out where our position is still after chatting and listening to Tim.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I mean, how lucky were we to get Tim on? I just find that on a farm level for us, the carbon reduction ignores all the other great stuff we're doing on farm. So it doesn't take into account like the social sustainability, like having school visits on farm or employing local people, giving great jobs to people, or like the environmental stuff, like the wildlife we have on farm. I worry about being in a silo and not seeing out of that, if that makes sense. Yeah. So he left me feeling quite empowered that we could make a difference on farm. But I would really like the conversation to also involve all the other things that farmers are already doing great on farm, because I don't think we celebrate those enough. I think Tim's whole thing was that collectively we can make a difference, and we need to not think about this as just one farm. Like, it makes it much easier to comprehend that we can by thinking, oh, well, if I do it and Ali does it with his arable farm, et cetera, then maybe we can make a difference. But also I like the bit around that resilience, so that actually by heading towards net zero on our personal farms, that actually we were going to increase our resilience to things that are out of our control, you know, that like the climate crisis that we are in, you know, over the summer was a nightmare. I mean, back to the question, the UK's share of global emissions is 1%. Why should UK farmers still aim for net zero? I'm happy to aim for net zero as long as everything else is being recognised and I'm being financially rewarded for my share of it. How do you feel, Ali?
I think, yeah, absolutely. Obviously, financial reward is, as we talked about in the first pod, is sustainability starts at the bottom line. I think that for me, it's not burying your head in the sand and not thinking that you don't matter. That's what I think it's a case of you do matter. If everyone has the same attitude as that, then nothing goes forward. And that's not just necessarily in sustainability. That's in everything, in business, in everything. If everyone had the attitude of being like, well, I don't matter, there's no point in doing something, we would make no progress. There would be no progress in the world. So by starting to do something, by putting yourself potentially out of your comfort zone and by trying to achieve something that maybe you think is more socially correct, then I think that there is a opportunity to sort of matter, I guess. That's the thing, isn't it? It's so much more than just farming. It's so much more than just us. So making sure that we feel empowered, as you have said many times here, is is important, but also making sure that we have a go and don't just sort of bury our heads in the sand, because we are going to have to cope with this.
That has been great. I've really enjoyed discussing this, Ali. I'd love to hear from you guys out there. What do you think? Do you think we should be heading towards net zero, or should we just be focusing on producing sustainable food in the best way we can? We're now going to roll on to our next section, which I'm so excited about. We're going to be talking about Christmas trees, pumpkins last episode, but Christmas trees today.
Move straight from Halloween. Halloween's out. Christmas is on, apparently. Now, I am very lucky to know a man called George Hood, who is the managing director of a company called Needle Fresh, who are a grower-owned cooperative producing Christmas trees for the UK. And when I found out that we were doing Christmas trees, I was like, oh, I've got to have a chat with George, because he is A, fascinating. And actually, I feel like I should have got him on, because he would have been brilliant. He's so passionate about Christmas trees. And I think the first thing to talk about is this push towards Christmas being now. That's something I am struggling with, because Halloween has finished. It's been so commercialized that everyone in the shops, the retail sector, is like, oh, crumbs, Halloween's finished. What are we going to sell now? Oh, I know, it's Christmas in 12 weeks' time. I know it's not 12 weeks, but for this purpose, call it 12 weeks. Christmas is months away. Why are we even talking about Christmas?
I know exactly what you're saying. I actually had my first mince pie at bonfire night, actually. I know, outrageous. No. And it wasn't homemade as well. So really terrible on my front. But I do get it. And so many of my friends, mainly the ones with kids, or actually dogs, like to put their dog in front of a Christmas tree and take a picture. Very much. Probably 30% of them have a tree up already. I want to know how they get them to last until Christmas. Or is it all about the fake tree?
Do you want to know where Christmas trees first originated in the UK? Do you know?
No. Come on, give it to me.
Prince Albert in 1841. He brought a Christmas tree back in to Windsor Castle. I think there may have been a Christmas tree that had arrived in the UK before then, but it became popular because Prince Albert brought a Christmas tree back to Windsor Castle in 1841. And then in 1848, the royal family had their photograph taken in front of the Christmas tree. And that's where popularity of Christmas trees massively increased. And in those days, it was all the Norway spruce. That was where it came from. It had come from Norway. But that has now dropped in the market massively. And I reckon you can tell why the Norway spruce has gone and the Norman fir has come back. Do you know?
No, you're going to tell me anyway.
You must know. Needle drop. No one wants needle drop. And that's the big thing. So the Norway spruce was the traditional Christmas tree, came into the UK, coming in from Norway. But the needles drop, like, tragically, as I'm sure you have had in the past, a Christmas tree. And then you touch it and the entire needles just fall on the entire tree, just sheds its leaves, basically. So everything now has moved to the Norman fir. Which is about 85% of the UK market, from what George was telling me. But the popularity is phenomenal. 8 to 10 million trees in the UK every single year. So I don't know the percentages. I did ask George about this because I said, what are the challenges in the market? And the first challenge actually links really nicely into our big debate topic, is that Christmas is coming earlier. In theory, it's obviously not coming early because it's still on the 25th of December, which is a long way away. Stop buying your Christmas trees in November. But when his dad set the business up in 1996, they didn't start supplying Christmas trees till the 1st of December. And he was saying that now, basically, their Christmas sales are done by the 1st of December. So they will start supplying cut trees from this weekend, which is wild. The problem they're having is that because we're having a warmer autumn, is that Norman fir, the tree of choice, once that's had a frost on it, it stops photosynthesizing, so it basically stops growing. That means they can cut it and then they can palletize it and pack it, and it won't rot. It just sits in a dormant state. Because we're not getting these frosts now, and Christmas is coming earlier, they're having to cut the trees and they have to leave them exactly in situ for a minimum of 3 to 4 days. Because if they pack them too soon, the tree is still photosynthesizing and the trees will just rot on the pallet. And that's something that that's a real threat to their business, because Christmas has come earlier and because we are having a slightly warming November, especially this year, like it's 15 degrees outside at the moment. That's mad. Is that keep getting trees to stay fresh for longer, particularly cut trees, is going to be a real issue for them going forward.
Fascinating. I feel like we've found the next diversification project for your farm, growing Christmas trees. I'm going to tell you something that, yeah, I mean, we do not have a Christmas tree at home. It sounds a bit mean, especially having children, but we have a bit of a tradition over the last 7 years to have a Christmas bush. We go out into...
Christmas bush?
An actual Christmas bush, yeah. Think what you like. But we go out on the estate and with a handsaw, actually. Don't want to do too much damage. And we handsaw a limb off a big tree and bring it back. And then we tie it to our window. We do it about 2 weeks before. And it's just become a tradition. So it's, I feel like, very sustainable about it. I feel like a real cheapskate as well. And actually, our neighbours were so embarrassed by this, they actually brought us a tree round. Because they heard about the bush. So, yeah, we have a Christmas bush. It takes the sustainability box. And you've got the excuse you don't have to have one too early as well. So, to me, it's perfect. It's a tradition I will not be changing.
Each to their own. Each to their own. And absolutely, I think, you know, Christmas is for you. And I think on that note, we're going to finish because I don't think I can hold it together any longer. This has been wide-ranging this week. Very wide-ranging this week. We've covered COP. We've covered why we should bother trying to be carbon neutral. Our news stories, which have been interesting. And we have also covered Christmas trees. So thank you very much to everyone for listening. Thank you for your feedback. Feel free to message us across social media if you have any questions or if you want, there's something that you really want us to discuss. We've had some really good ones in, which we'll be looking to put into future episodes. The email address is thebigdebate@ruralpodmedia.co.uk. Thank you very much to our headline partners, Virgin Money, as well as our associate partners, Birkett's and Telus Agriculture and Consumer Goods. We will be back in 2 weeks' time. Make sure you subscribe so that you listen to us, and I will look forward to seeing you all then. Meet the Farmers, The Big Debate is produced by Rural Pod Media. Our headline partner for this episode was Virgin Money, whose agricultural team supports farmers up and down the UK with expert financial advice backed by years of experience and a deep understanding of the farming sector. Contact details can be found at virginmoney.com/business/agriculture. That's virginmoney.com/business/agriculture.